It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many public radio listeners became a fan of Mike Birbiglia back when he was that hilarious guy with the name we couldn't pronounce who told stories about sleepwalking on This American Life. Stories like this one.
It's 5 years ago, and I'm in Walla Walla, Washington. I'm lying in bed at La Quinta Inn. I'm watching the news, I'm Googling myself, and I'm eating a pizza all at the same time. And I fall asleep and have a dream that there's a guided missile headed towards my room, and I jump out of bed, and I say, what's the plan? And they said, the missile coordinates are set specifically on you. So I decide in my dream, and as it turns out, in my life, to jump out my window so as to detonate outside the window for the sake of the platoon. In my dreams, I'm a hero. And there are two important details. One, I was on the second floor. Two, the window was closed. It was January, so I jumped through a window like the Hulk. And I say that because that's how I described it at the emergency room. It's a very difficult thing to explain when one has jumped through a window. I was like, you know the Hulk? You know how he kind of just kind of jumps through stuff? Yeah, that's like me. I have this habit of preemptively shouting when something traumatic is about to happen. Like, if someone were going to come up to me after the show and punch me in the face, I would just go, ah! Thinking maybe he'd be like, this is weird. I'm out of here. I'm not punching the shouting guy. And so I jumped through the window and I screamed, ah! And what was remarkable was that I landed on the front lawn and I took a fall and I got up and I kept running. And I'm running, and I'm slowly realizing I'm on the front lawn of La Quinta Inn in Y-O-Y-O, Washington, in my underwear, bleeding. And I'm like, oh, no. But in that moment, I was relieved that I hadn't been hit by the missile.
Mike Birbiglia telling his story, The Missile, from his album Sleepwalk With Me. Nowadays, Mike Birbiglia is a very successful comedian, author, and filmmaker, and a whole lot of people have learned how to say his name. He's touring right now with his show Thank God for Jokes, and he'll be playing in Des Moines at Hoyt Sherman Place on Saturday night at 7:30. Hello, Mike.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, of course. I'm weirdly choked up. I just watched this movie that I'm in called The Fault in Our Stars that comes out in a couple weeks. I just watched a sneak preview, and so I'm like, I'm just post-crying.
Oh, right now. Wow.
Yeah, but thanks for having me on.
Well, the rest of the nation will be crying with you very soon is what I read about that film.
It's a heavy one.
You have been called by many, the master of the personal embarrassing tale. When did you realize that sharing the most embarrassing thing about yourself was going to get you the biggest laughs?
That's an embarrassing question to answer. I think somewhere in my mid-20s or mid-late 20s, I started doing comedy when I was, you know, probably a teenager, and I pursued it in college. I was in the improv group. I won the college comedy funniest person on campus contest. I was working the door at the DC Improv Comedy Club, and so I did comedy for a long time, but it wasn't until probably in my mid-20s where I started to sort of toy with the idea of, like, what if I told this really embarrassing story that makes me feel entirely uncomfortable to tell? And what I found when I would do it was I would actually feel closer to the audience, you know, like I would feel like a kinship with strangers in this way that was very different from just stand-up comedy. Stand-up comedy is, you know, typically this very, like, you tell a joke, people laugh, you tell a joke, people laugh, or don't, which is common as well. And when you tell a story, I feel like you're sort of befriending the audience. You're basically saying, like, hey, come on into my existence for, you know, a little bit, and we can try to find some commonality.
Do you remember the first time you did that?
I did it for The Moth. You know, the radio show. Well, it's now a radio show, but it was at the time, it was just a storytelling series in New York City. And they asked me to tell a story, and I told the title story from my last one-person show, which is, if people want to see it, it's on Netflix. It's called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. And it is basically a story about how when I was in high school, I was sort of a late bloomer, and then I had my first girlfriend when I was a senior in high school, and there was one snag.
Was that she told me not to tell anyone that she was my girlfriend. I know. I'm in the future. Also, I think we can all see now. We're so smart and Mike's so dumb. And now I can also see in retrospect that's a much bigger red flag than I perceived it to be at the time. But I was so excited she was even with me at all. And she said she had another boyfriend at home, but they were in the process of breaking up, but it was a bad time because his parents were sick. And so I tried to be understanding of that, and I went along with it for a few months until she invited me to meet her parents. And I thought, well, this is the affirmation that I need. I'm going to be crowned as the main boyfriend. And I drive my mom's station wagon to Amanda's parents' house, and I walk in the front door, and there's Amanda, and there's her parents, and it's going well. And a few hours go by, and this other guy comes over to the house, and his name is Scott. And I'm assuming he's like a family friend or a relative. And slowly I'm noticing similarities between Scott and things that Amanda has said about her other boyfriend. They're both in their first year in college, and they're competitive wrestlers. And it's dawning on me that I'm hanging out with my girlfriend's boyfriend. It's going pretty well. I mean, he seemed like a nice guy. I could totally see what she saw in him. There was some consolation that when he would go in the other room to the kitchen or the bathroom, she would hold on to my hand and she would say, "I wish it were just you and me here." And I remember thinking, you could make that happen.
And then he suggests that we go, this is totally true, by the way, he suggests that we go hang out at his house and I meet his parents. And I say in the show, I say, it's very nerve-wracking meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend's parents for the first time. Part of you is angry for obvious reasons, but then part of you still wants to make a good impression. You're like, maybe if this goes well, she'll see that I'm good with adults in general, you know. And that was actually, it was like, you know, it's funny you should ask that, like, when I was comfortable telling stories like that, because that was a story that happened in my life, and I was like, I will never speak of this again. Like, I'm never going to say this out loud. And then, I don't know, I feel like there's almost like a statute of limitations where in your life where at a certain point you're like, well, it happened 10 years ago, I think that's okay, And then, yeah, that's sort of how it happened. And then I really felt a real connection with audiences, and I started telling more stories like that.
Well, and even in recounting the telling of that story, you just said to me, no, this is totally true. I'm
well,
sure people question that a lot.
Concept, you know?
Yeah. Well, do you embellish?
I do embellish, but I don't embellish. I always say when I tell stories, I tell emotionally truthful stories. I don't want to steer people into something that sort of just doesn't ring true or isn't like basically when I do my shows, the things I'm embellishing are not the things that you would sort of care about. They're just sort of conveniences in storytelling. So in, you know, in Sleepwalk With Me, my movie, for example, like, my parents don't live in Long Island in real life. They live in Massachusetts. And, you know, my girlfriend wasn't an acting teacher. She was, you know, an actress. And, you know, there's all this kind of stuff like that. But like, for example, like the thing that people wouldn't believe in Sleepwalk With Me, which is like that I jumped through a second story window while sleeping, that actually did happen. So that's sort of where my internal rules lie for truth telling.
You have told so many personal stories, and it has brought you success Do you reject some stories as too personal?
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about certain stories, and I'm like, yeah, maybe another 5 years for that one. And also, I'm married, and so there's some degree of, like, with my last show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, so much of it is about my relationship with my wife, Jenny, and fortunately, she's a writer, and so, you know, we were able to kind of talk through stuff, and she ended up sort of writing, you know, the best lines of it, you know, in a lot of ways, because they were her lines. I would say this happened, and she would go, well, I remember it like this. I said this, you said this, I said this, and then you know, and now we go, oh, well, let me write this down. And so in a lot of ways, yeah, you have to be cautious when you're married or close with your family. Fortunately, my parents don't go to a lot of my shows, so that that excludes them. It's true. My parents don't go to a lot of my shows. They actually came last year. I played Carnegie Hall, which was obviously a great honor. And Ira Glass opened up the show with his live touring show, which people should see, with the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company, and they opened up. And my parents came, but I think only because it would just be such a cliche if they didn't come. Like, you play Carnegie Hall, which is for your parents, really. It's the only reason you play Carnegie Hall, and if they don't show up, then, you know, then they're going to give me, you know, stories for years to come.
Right. Too much material.
Too much material, yeah, yeah.
I was looking through your blog, and I read a blog post that you put up in February, and it was a riff about snow emergency.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and you were talking about how when you were a kid, a snow emergency was when your brother stuck snow down your pants.
Yeah.
But something that you said in that was about how very similar crying hysterically is to laughing hysterically, because that's how your brother got out of getting in trouble, because he would have you crying and then he would make you laugh and he'd say to your mom, well, yeah, if he's so upset.
He would say, why is he laughing? If he's so upset, why is he laughing? But he had made me laugh moments before. It is it's a dangerous truism how close laughing and crying are to each other.
Well, and it makes me think about the incredible vulnerability that you show on stage, because you are telling these very personal, very painful stories. The audience is empathizing with you. I mean, you have that great line where you just pause and you say, I know, I'm in the future as well.
Yeah, I'm in the future also, yeah.
And we're all kind of vicariously experiencing your pain, but somehow it's making us laugh.
Well, that's the trick of the whole thing, and that's what takes years to develop these shows, is, like, you have to ultimately be telling the story of the audience, not really of yourself. Like, something that is true of you, but also is true of basically everyone in the room. So, like, one of the things that was wild about that story I just told you about my girlfriend's boyfriend, my first girlfriend in high school, is that I swear, when I would tour that show, I toured that show to 70 cities around the world, like Australia, London, Canada, America, all over America. Without fail, every single show, at least one person, sometimes multiple people, would come up to me when I'm signing stuff after the show, and they would say, that exact same thing happened to me. And I would be like, what do you mean? That really specific thing of meeting your girlfriend's boyfriend happened to you? And they would say, yeah. And I feel like that's actually one of the really kind of cathartic things about storytelling, is that the more you tell stories to people, the more you realize how much of this painful stuff happens to everybody. And I think that's why it's worth it.
You have had a lot of success in your career now. And I know that you're married, and I hope that you're happy. Do you worry at all about experiencing happiness and success, and maybe that robbing you of new material?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it definitely crosses my mind, just because I'm a neurotic person, so I worry about everything, and it's, you know, it's my livelihood and all that. But it's funny, because 2 years ago, my movie Sleepwalk With Me was at Sundance Film Festival, which was a dream come true. It was like, I thought I've dreamed of making movies since I was in high school. And there I was, like, at Sundance, and my film was there, and it was just this dream come true. And then my brother Joe was like, let's go skiing. And I was like, oh, great, you know. And then we go skiing, and I catch an edge while we're skiing in the mountains, and I end up in sort of what they call a yard sale accident, where, you know, just strewn down the mountain 50 yards are, like, my gloves and my hat and, you know, my skis and my poles and everything. And I broke my shoulder. I fractured the ball of my shoulder. And I'm in so much pain. I'm, like, in screeching pain. And then we go back to the hotel, and I get into the hot tub at the hotel. And I realize as I'm in the hot tub that my cell phone is in my pocket, which is not advisable for a cell phone. They don't sell any water minutes. But and so it was like moments like that where you realize that there will always be comedy because there will always be tragedy. Like, there's no shortage of tragedy in the world, and comedy is tragedy plus time. So I don't think we're going to run out.
Although I have seen other comedians, I'm sure you have too, where it seems like success really robs them of their edge.
I think you're right. I'm very aware of that, but I think that people listening would if they saw sort of a camera, a small, like, mini camera hidden in my life, they would be like, oh, that's what my life is like too. Like, most cities I fly in, I rent a car, I drive to the venue myself. You know what I mean? Like, my life is a lot, you know. I live in an apartment in Brooklyn with my wife and cat. Like, my life is a lot like other people's lives. Like, I think, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why that is, but I agree with you. I mean, there is something to, you do see certain celebrities move to Hollywood and then their lives get a little smoother, and maybe they're a little less funny, but we're not going to name names. Why would we do that? We're not going to disparage people. But I think, you know, I'm staying in New York, which is, I think, part of the key. There's a lot of strife in New York, a lot of joyful strife.
How much time do you spend on the road in a year?
Well, this year is a really wild one. It is, I'm in 100 cities over the course of the year. That doesn't include, like, multiple shows and, you know, multiple nights. So, like, I'll probably be on the road this year probably 180 days or so, which is hard. You know, it's rigorous. But I love this show. Like, this show, Thank God for Jokes, is, like, I think it might be the funniest show I've ever done. I don't know that it's the best show I've ever done. I don't believe in that in terms of evaluating art. But like, in terms of the laughs, like, the laughs are probably the biggest of any tour I've ever done, which is, it's pretty thrilling on stage.
How have the audiences changed? I mean, you've been very popular for a long time. Have you hit a plateau, or do they keep growing?
No, they grow, I think. I mean, it's, this tour is by far the biggest, and it's what's cool about my audiences is that they came to see me on purpose. Like, when I started out in comedy, like, 15 years ago, it would just be like, tonight, comedy night, like at Fat Tuesday's Bar and Grill or whatever, and I would be like one of four comedians, and you know, for a lot of people, you know, I'm just not for everybody. I'm just not, you know, what I do is very specific. I'm not beating people over the head with things, and sometimes it's a little more subtle than some people would like, and so you know, out of like 100 people in the audiences of those shows, like, probably 3 of them would come up to me and be like, you are my favorite, like it was a secret. Like, don't tell anyone you were my favorite. And I think over the years I've kind of accumulated those 3 per audience, and now what happens is all those people come to my show, and then it's kind of like this big, I feel like it's a group of friends at my shows. Like, I feel like they could have like a dating service at my shows of single Birbiglia fans who should meet each other, because I feel like we all share like a sense of humor, and we all have a thing in common, and it's really kind of special. And also, like, what's great about it is, like, I don't almost ever get recognized in the street or anything like that, which is great, and also contributes to what you were saying of, like, you know, that my life hasn't changed all that much, and so my life experiences are just kind of similar to other people's.
You just got done filming a role in The Fault in Our Stars.
Yes.
Are there other projects, other movie projects, that kind of thing on the horizon?
I'm in, Judd Apatow is directing a film this month, starting this month, called Trainwreck, and I play Brie Larson's husband and Amy Schumer's brother-in-law, and it's a really, really funny script Amy Schumer wrote. And so we're just about to start that. I just shot a part in Joe Swanberg's next film, which I don't think has a title yet, but it's a good one. It's got Anna Kendrick and Jake Johnson from The New Girl, and it's an improvised movie. I just shot that, and I'm writing two screenplays right now to be sort of my next two films, and so hopefully I'll be shooting that in 2015. This sentence is so long. I'm just realizing that this is such a run-on sentence of like, and then this. But anyway, but the most important thing is that I'm coming to Des Moines.
On the very top of your list.
Yeah.
So do you, with all of these other projects, do you see yourself continuing to tour?
I think so, yeah. People always ask me that, like it's some kind of a curse. But
Well, you didn't make it sound like very much fun, actually.
Performing it, was that?
You didn't make it sound like very much fun, all the traveling and the car rentals.
You know what's funny? The traveling is the hard part, and the shows are so much fun. So it's this double-edged sword. Like, I feel like I would, you know, I always tell people, like, I'm like a traveling salesman who sells comedy, and it's the... I would do the performance part for free. It's just they have to pay me to get on a plane. Like, that's really all it is I just hate the travel side. But yeah, I mean, I think I could – I don't know if I'm going to continue doing 200 days a year. Like I don't know if that's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, I love it. I like people. I like my audiences. I like my fans. Like, I dig the whole thing. I think it's very you know, travel is good for the mind. Like, it's just it keeps you thinking.
Mike Birbiglia, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Well, the sleepwalking got worse. Abby and I graduated from school, and we moved to Brooklyn. We had a very small apartment, but it was comfy, you know. We had a big puffy couch and two cats, and we made our first major purchase. We bought a TiVo. And one night I had a dream that I was in the Olympics for some kind of arbitrary event, like dustbustering. And it told me that I got third place. And I stood up on the third place podium, and I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I'm new to the sport, you know. Even in my dreams, I don't win, per se. In my wildest dreams, I place. And they say, actually, we reconsidered and we decided that you got second place. And I move over to the second place podium and it starts wobbling. And it's wobbling and wobbling. And I wake up and I'm falling off the top of our 5-foot bookcase in our living room. And I land on the floor hard on top of our TiVo. I know. And it breaks into pieces. And it was like one of these stories you hear where people black out drinking and they wake up in Idaho. They don't know where they are. They're just like, oh, no. Hardee's, you know, or whatever's there. But it was in my own living room. I was just like, oh, no. TiVo pieces. And I get up and I go back to bed, and Abby wakes me up in the morning and she says, Michael, what happened to the TiVo? And I say, I got second place. And I'm really sorry.
Mike Birbiglia. He is touring the country right now with his latest show, Thank God for Jokes. And he'll be performing in Des Moines on Saturday night at Hoyt Sherman Place. He's also going to be appearing on the big screen coming up in June in the movie The Fault in Our Stars. And he's also recently become a regular panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.